All right. Thank you very much for the organizers. Thank you for having me. And thanks very much for John for giving an excellent theoretical motivation to our paper. Yes, I'm going to use some of the insights in John and Hume's work and apply those to exchange rates. And so this is joint work with Tobias Adrian and Hyun Shin. And the views expressed in this paper, of course, they're ours and don't represent those of the New York Fed or the Federal Reserve System. So there's been a lot of literature on forecasting exchange rates and determining short-term fluctuations in exchange rates. And there's sort of like three broad strands of literature in this category. So the first strand is sort of just trying to forecast exchange rates, short-term fluctuations in exchange rates out of samples. And this goes back to the Mies-Rogoff random walk benchmark. And there's been some challengers to these benchmarks, but Ken Rogoff has been very active in trying to fight those challengers. There's also this approach of sort of trying to understand the failure of the uncovered interest rate parity based on risk premium. So the fact that uncovered interest rate parity doesn't work, so in other words, high interest rate currencies tend to appreciate rather than depreciate, has been attributed to risk premium. And then there's this third strand of literature that sort of takes the kind of like a market microstructure or flow approach to exchange rates. And here, the most interesting paper in the context of our work is 1997 paper by Lyons, which basically says that, well, 80% of all foreign exchange volume is trading between dealers. So presumably the information content of exchange rates is very low at short horizons. And there's some other flow-based work along those lines as well, just theoretical. So we sort of combine elements from these three strands to show that, well, financial intermediaries do matter. In particular, as John showed, financial intermediaries, these kind of guys who maximize expected return on equity subject to some value at risk rule, their risk appetite fluctuates a lot, and that's reflected in asset prices. And we show that the risk appetite of US dollar funded intermediaries is actually reflected in the risk premia in the FX markets. In particular, they forecast the US dollar exchange rate going forward. And then we also show that this forecastability can be attributed to systematic fluctuations in risk premia. So here's a little piece of motivation. So what's so special about leveraged financial intermediaries? As you know from John's model, these leveraged financial intermediaries, they have very aggressive balance sheet management practices. So here's just an example from a paper by Tobias and Hume, 2007. So here, this left side plots the asset growth of households against the leverage growth of households quarterly. So we can see that, you know, as the value of your house goes up, your leverage, your financial leverage, mechanically goes down. So for passive investors, we tend to observe figures like this. Now, for investment banks, the whole story is completely different. So as their value of assets goes up, they use up that extra balance sheet capacity to crank up leverage as well. So to an outside observer, it would be as if the risk-bearing capacity or risk appetite, the effective risk aversion, whatever you want to call it, it's fluctuating over time with market conditions. And indeed, this should be reflected in aggregate asset prices. So if the risk appetite of a large player in the market changes over time, we should observe fluctuations in risk premium in aggregate asset prices. And indeed, there's some empirical work which has already shown results along these lines. So first paper, Adrian Shin, show that these kind of fluctuations in short-term funding aggregates forecast the VIX, in particular the VIX risk premium. And I have a paper which shows that these kind of fluctuations also forecast commodity returns, where intermediaries play a large role in commodity derivatives markets. And there's also some recent work on linking these fluctuations to macroeconomy. And of course, on the theory side, Prunemeyer and Peterson sort of examined this role of between funding liquidity and market liquidity, and then John and co-authors sort of laid out this endogenous risk framework, which we will be applying in this paper to a large extent, and showing some additional tricks as well related to empirical estimation of the model. And we talked about the value at risk constraint. So there is this one paper by Adrian Shin, which sort of derives a microeconomic foundation for the value at risk constraint from a sort of moral hazard problem. So let's just move on. So our contribution, we sort of start with the premise that FX positions, foreign exchange trading positions, are much like any other risky investment positions. So if you just consider a simplest FX position, which is just a US dollar funded investment in riskless foreign debt. So in this kind of excess return, the only risk stems from these fluctuations in the exchange rate. And now, if the risk preferences or effective risk aversion of these US dollar funded investors change over time, something should happen to these exchange rates to adjust to those changes in risk premium. And we model effective risk aversion of US dollar funded investors by looking at short-term dollar credit aggregates, in particular overnight repo and financial commercial paper outstanding. I will talk more about why we choose those aggregates. And the simple intuition is that as the US dollar funding liquidity increases, dollar-funded investors require lower risk premia on their risky positions, including those in foreign currencies and abroad, and that forecasts an appreciation of the US dollar going forward. Very, very simple mechanism. And note that this is separate from the familiar carry trade channel, whereby, you know, you read in a newspaper, risk appetite goes up, Aussie dollar, New Zealand dollar appreciates, Japanese yen depreciates. This is a typical story that you hear. But as I will show in our empirical results, our channel is separate from this carry trade channel, in particular as the risk appetite of dollar-funded investors increase, the US dollar is expected to appreciate across both low and high-yielding currencies. So there's typically a contemporaneous depreciation of the dollar and an appreciation of the dollar occurs across the board going forward. So this kind of like a level effect in the FX market. So just a brief outline of the talk. So I'll start out with empirical results, given that John gave an excellent theoretical motivation, and then I'll play around with the Valuet risk theoretical model, so examine the role of funding constraints in asset pricing, and sort of try and take a next step in better understanding the empirical implications of that framework. And then I, as a third step, I reconcile the theory empirics and sort of try to argue that the forecastability that we observe, it's not mispricing, it's in fact compensation for risk. So the data we use, we start in 93, go to the end of 2007. I can show you some figures over the crisis as well, but we just want to avoid sort of contaminating with our model. Well, actually, our model would work through the crisis as well, but we don't want to contaminate the in-sample results with those events. So we used exchange rates data from both advanced countries as well as emerging markets. Interest rates, 30-day money market rates are equivalent for each country. And in the balance sheet data side, we used dollar short-term credit aggregates, in particular primary dealer overnight repos and financial commercial paper outstanding. The advantage of this data is that it's published weekly by the Federal Reserve, well, both the board as well as the New York Fed. So this is balance sheet data available at very high frequencies. So we're going to use that to basically forecast exchange rates at short as weekly horizons. So what do these series look like? So primary dealer repos, financial commercial paper, outstanding. So this plots the outstanding quantities, well, values in trillions on a log scale, starting in 93, going back to the end of 2007. So obviously both of these quantities have grown quite substantially, but they've hardly moved in lockstep. And we detrend these series, and we detrend them out of sample to get stationary series that look like this. And here you say that, as a matter of fact, there is a negative correlation between commercial paper and... Oh, so if you detrended these in sample, just relative to a linear time trend, so you just regress the series on a linear time trend, but that would give you look-ahead bias. Yeah, so we recursively detrended to, and actually these series, they go back to the 1990s, so we use that extra bit of data to do the detrend. So these series have hardly moved in lockstep, and as a matter of fact, they have negative correlation. We don't really talk about this correlation in the paper, but it's quite interesting. And seems to be the type of a substitution effect almost between repo and commercial paper, which is understandable. So repo tends to increase in good times, CP tends to decrease, and then again CP tends to increase when times deteriorate. So this is something that we find systematically in these funding markets, and it would be interesting to do further research on this. So in terms of the empirical strategy, I'll start out with in-sample analysis, so just country by country, OLS regressions, forecasting regressions, and then I'll show you some robustness checks within the panel regression. Of course, there's correlation. We have a panel of exchange rates relative to the dollar. So obviously there's both cross-sectional correlation and time series correlation. So we account for those in calculating the standard errors. And then I'll show you some out-of-sample tests as well, where the betas are estimated recursively from the panel regression. Okay, so let's start here. So on the left-hand side, we have the exchange rate growth of each of these countries. And on the right-hand side of the regression, we have lagged, detrended repo, and financial commercial paper. And as we can see, so these are monthly regressions. And do the question. That is absolutely true. We haven't accounted for that, but we've run the same regressions with the French franc, and results are similar. I'm not familiar with the extent to which you know, euro and German marks are very different. My understanding has been that they behave quite similarly, but. That's right. Also, our focus is on the US dollar relative to all other exchange rates, so we're not picky about what exchange rates we compare to. R-squared so low? Forecasting exchange rates? Monthly horizons? All right, so these are huge R-squares. For those of you who are not familiar with the exchange rate forecasting literature, it's been almost impossibility to forecast short-term, monthly growth rates of exchange rates. So we're quite proud of these R-squares. See, New Zealand, for instance, we get an R-squared over 8%. So you can, I work with the Federal Reserve, so I'm not going to say anything about that. But so these are quite attractive forecasting results. And remarkable thing is that just as you would expect, an increase in dollar-funded risk appetite forecasts an appreciation of the U.S. dollar against all of these currencies. So all the coefficients are positive. Both the Japanese yens and the Aussie and New Zealand dollars. And we can do the same exercise for emerging market currencies. Here, the results are a bit weaker. As you might suspect, there's some noise and other things going on in these less developed countries. But the qualitative results are the same. So whenever we see a significant coefficient, it's positive. And now we can move on to looking at the forecastability in light of the existing forecasters, common known forecasters of exchange rates. So let's start out by putting the advanced countries, so the advanced exchange rate growth on the left-hand side, and in a panel, and regressing those on some lagged forecasting variables. So here we see that just using the repo and CP, we get an adjusted R-square about 3.7% in this cross-section. Then adding the lagged FX growth, not doing much. Adding the carry, so the interest rate differential between the foreign country and the U.S. So here we see the typical forward premium puzzle. So this says that high interest rate currencies tend to appreciate relative to the dollar. So again, I want to emphasize the fact that our channel is separate from the carry trade channel. Add some more covariates. So we add the annual stock market return differential, not significant. The US interest rates, not significant. And then we'll add some other variables. These are motivated by the paper by Bruno Meyer, Nagel, and Peterson, where they basically forecast currency crashes. So they show that the VIX multiplied by the interest rate differential, which gives them the signed VIX, is a good forecasting variable for currency crashes. And similarly, the signed TED. So we can see that here in this specification, the signed TED has some significance. But the key point being that both the magnitude and the statistical significance of our two forecasting variables, repo and CP, remain constant, if not even increase, when you add these covariates in the regression. And you can see a similar phenomenon by looking at the adjusted R squares. So we started out with the adjusted R square of 3.7 in the first specification. And as you add a kitchen sink of stuff on the right hand side, you only go to 4.6 in adjusted R square. Yep. Yep. The results are very similar. And we've added a bunch of other stuff: money growth, different measures of the business cycle, GDP growth, all sorts of things. And the results are quite robust. And then we can do the same thing for all countries. And as we noticed from the individual OLS regressions, there's some funny things going on in the group of developing countries. As a matter of fact, we didn't have significance for the repo for most emerging markets. So these results for the sample of 23 countries reflect that result. So we have lower adjusted R square. Detrended repo is not significant for specifications other than the very last one when you put all the other covariates in there. And also here you notice that the carry actually here has a sign consistent with the UIP. But we emphasize the results for the developed countries, as this is essentially a story of US dollar funded large investors investing in evaluated portfolio of world currency. And we can also do the same exercise weekly and quarterly. So of course, when you do the exercise at weekly horizons, the R squared drops, but this is weekly. I don't know if anyone actually forecasting exchange rates as short as weekly horizons, apart from guys doing flow-based forecasting, such as Evans and Lyons, but even their results are not quite robust out of sample. But these results can be taken to out of sample as well, as I will show you. And quarterly results are similar. And of course, this forecasting ability increases as you increase the forecast horizon. So here we start with a 1 month horizon, R squared being about 3.74 there. And you increase the horizon, so you can see that at around 10-month horizon, you get an R squared of over 20%. This is, again, monthly forecast horizon. And then it starts tapering off slightly. And now you might think that, well, we're looking at the world from a U.S. perspective. So you might say that, well, if you look at the world from the perspective of a euro or a yen-funded investor, you should observe a similar result. So as the euro funding liquidity or the yen funding liquidity increases, that should forecast an appreciation of those currencies relative to the rest of the currencies. And this is exactly what we do in this table. So here we have a euro-based panel of exchange rates, 9 exchange rates, and we regress that exchange rate growth on these lagged variables, and here we have euro-denominated repos. Well, that market is not as big as the dollar-denominated repo market, but we did manage to find some data on this, and you can see the analogous effect. So an increase in euro funding liquidity forecasts an appreciation of the euro going forward, and similarly for yen. Again, there's a positive coefficient there. So this lends support to this idea that the funding liquidity of investors is linked to the risk premium or the required returns that those investors demand on their investments. Unfortunately, we didn't find any commercial paper data in these currencies that would have been reliable. And okay, I'm just going to show you out-of-sample results. You must be bored with these tables already, but here we do the ultimate test, which is the out-of-sample test for the advanced currencies, and we use the Clark West adjusted mean squared error as our statistic, and then compute the p-values on that statistic. So we get some forecastability for Australia, Canada, Germany, well, basically all the countries apart from Japan in this out-of-sample exercise. And we can do the same thing for the emerging markets, and here the forecastability is a bit more sparse, so but we still have Chile, Colombia, Hungary, India, South Africa, Turkey, and note that we computed tests both against random walk benchmark as well as the AR1 benchmark. You can do a bunch of other benchmarks as well, including random walk with the drift and other things, but usually random walk benchmark is the hardest beat. So, with these empirical results, how much time do I have? Excellent. Okay, so we can take a quick peek at the model. I'm gonna jump through the model because John presented a lot of the intuition. But essentially, we look at the world from the perspective of US-based financial investors who hold an internationally diversified portfolio. So, and we split the investors into two groups. Like in John's model, we got active investors, such as investment banks, primary dealers, and passive investors. And here our requirement is that these investors must hold an internationally diversified portfolio. So we take the other U.S. financials as the passive group. So this includes commercial banks, insurance companies, and so forth. And if that portfolio is invested in riskless foreign bonds, we get the excess return on such carry trade, and the only risk stems from the exchange rate fluctuations. And the balance sheet of the active investors looks like this. So on the asset side, you've got some securities, and the liability side, you have equity, and then it tends to be that about 70% of the liabilities are repos and commercial paper for most primary dealers. And then you've got some long-term debt. Maximize expected return on equity subject to our favorite value at risk constraint, which is, like John showed, can be represented as a multiple kappa of equity volatility. And of course, these guys crank up leverage so that as much as they can so as to hit the value at risk constraint. Yes? You got a point, but this is, again, this is a stylized model. What we're trying to capture is the risk premium, whether you have normal returns or not. That will not affect the intuition of the model, obviously, but you got a point, yeah. And so we get this mean variance trade-off, but instead of having the coefficient, the relative risk aversion there, we got this Lagrange multiplier. So 1 over kappa times phi t here measures the risk appetite. So as the funding constraints get tighter, the phi t increases, so the active investor must reduce leverage. And then we close the model with passive investors. Here, however, we depart from John's approach by taking just simple mean variance optimization problems. So these passive guys, they have this myopic demand with coefficient of risk aversion gamma. And this simplifies the analysis quite a bit. So as a result, the market clearing looks like CAPM, essentially. So you got expected excess returns equal to the covariance of that return with the wealth portfolio times this big gamma T here, which we call the effective risk aversion of dollar-based investors. So it's essentially an equity-weighted or wealth-weighted average of the inverse risk appetites of the two investor classes. And RW here is the return on the wealth portfolio of these investors, which you can think of, say, an internationally diversified equity portfolio or something along those lines, or a carry trade portfolio, for that matter. Now, the innovation here is that you can actually, with a little bit of math, express this large gamma T as a function of observable balance sheet quantities. So here, large gamma T is the risk aversion coefficient of the passive investors times 1 plus the wealth of active investors or the wealth of passive investors times 1 minus leverage of the active over leverage of the market or the active and passive investors. So what you can do, you can construct this measure from observable data and then look at the shape and see if we can reconcile our empirical results with this kind of theory. So essentially, plucking this into the equilibrium returns expression, we get this kind of formula for the exchange rate growth. So here, when leverage of intermediary is high, equilibrium excess returns and risk positions are low, so the dollar is expected to appreciate. And now, let's see how we can actually reconcile this theory in empirics. So first, let's construct an empirical measure of this gamma. So just following the theory, we can choose a group of active investors and group of passive investors, look at their balance sheets over time. So here we choose active investors, US dollar, well, basically US primary dealers, and passive investors are the rest of the US financials. So we pluck those balance sheet components into this expression. And then we can ask the question, so do our higher frequency measures of funding liquidity, repos and CP, which remember they're observable as short as weekly, horizons, are they actually related to this gamma T, which we can observe quarterly using CompuStat data? So, and actually, we use both quarterly and monthly data. So we use the equity data from CRISP, and that's monthly, and then we interpolate the quarterly leverage to get a monthly series, and then we regress that on our measures, our high frequency measures, repo and commercial paper, and we're going to R squared is 62, and both of them are highly statistically significant, got the right sign. So high funding liquidity, as measured by repo and CP, associated with low effective risk aversion. And we can look at the plot and the projection as well. So here, the blue line is a measure of effective risk aversion using the CRISP and CompuStat data. And the red line is the projection of that onto our detrended repo and CP. And here we can sort of visualize the over 60% explanatory power of these high frequency variables. And this is a pretty interesting shape, so you can pick out some interesting qualitative features here. So here's the run-up of risk appetite before the LTCM crash. And then here is the run-up of a risk appetite before the current crash. What we were surprised about was that this increase in risk appetite or decrease in effective risk aversion here wasn't the more pronounced one. But here we have to remember that we're looking at the effective risk aversion of the U.S. financials, so effectively primary dealers relative to the rest of the U.S. financials. So we could conduct a similar exercise relative to the rest of the U.S. economy. But even then, the qualitative shape of the graph is not very different. So we were a little puzzled by this. So in other words, based on sort of this draft in effective risk aversion here versus this draft before the LTCM event, I don't know if one would have been able to forecast the crisis here. So that's end of 2008 over there. So there's this huge spike, outwards. So this we found quite interesting. Now, anyway, we can sort of switch gears and now actually look at whether this theoretically motivated measure of effective risk aversion can explain away the forecastability of repo and CP. And we conduct other tests in the paper, but I'm just going to show you the quick and dirty way here. So what we basically do first is to regress FX growth, just country by country, on this theoretically motivated lax measure of effective risk aversion. And then we take the residuals from that regression and regress those on lagged repo and lagged CP and test for Granger causality. And what we find that we cannot reject this hypothesis for all the advanced countries and 10 out of 14 emerging markets. So it really seems like the forecasting ability of repo and CP, as we found in the empirical section, seems to stand for the association with effective risk aversion. And this is indeed quite consistent with our intuition and the theoretical framework, simple theoretical framework that we laid out. So here's just some confirmation. So here I'm just showing the p-values of this Granger causality test. And it really seems that repo and CP don't help forecast exchange rates once you take into account the forecasting ability of the theoretical measure of effective risk aversion. Here in the set of emerging markets, there you got some forecastability left, but I'm quite skeptical of, I wouldn't put my money on forecasting the exchange rate of Turkey, for instance. So. So just to sum up, we found that short-term US dollar credit aggregates forecast US dollar appreciations in sample, out of sample, weekly, monthly, quarterly, and we attribute this predictability to time-varying effective risk aversion. US dollar funding liquidity determines expected excess returns on dollar-funded positions, include those in foreign currencies. And thank you very much. Question? Yeah.
What would your squares like if you just go back to your first regression and use gamma t, like the repo and
They're similar. They're almost the same. So, especially for the group of developed countries, we're quite.
When you have all three, does gamma capture the significance and the other two not?
It varies. It varies across currencies, but it seems that they're capturing very much of the same variation in the sort of level effect of the US dollar. I thought that, you know, everybody wants to go home, given that I was the last guy, so.
Thank you.